Thanks, Philip, and thanks to the organizers for inviting me. And thanks very much to Kate and Lynn for setting the stage for the talk that I'm going to give on organic production in here in California. So in my talk today, I'm going to emphasize research on organic vegetable systems in California. And the theme of the talk is this. It's using the variation that we find on actual farms to understand how organic production can influence soil microbial biomass activity and soil biodiversity. In fact, one big question is, this changes in microbial activity go hand in hand with soil biodiversity? I'm also going to try to show you some of our experimental designs for going on to real farms, comparing different farms and habitats, and also try to spin that out to how this kind of participatory research with farmers results in some outcomes. So I'm going to give a brief little explanation of what we're doing organic vegetable systems over the years, and then talk about three projects, the transition to organic production, habitat comparison for an organic farmscape, and a survey of 13 organic farm fields in one agricultural landscape. And then end with a few ideas and challenges for management of soil biota. So, first of all, this work was done by some amazing people who have been in my lab through the years, and I want to highlight two people, Sean Smuckler and Tim Bowles, whose PhD dissertations have been highlighted in this talk. We also have had many other research collaborators who have been involved in these studies, and also many farmers and ranchers in Yolo and Monterey counties. So the soil food web and biodiversity is shown in this marvelous diagram by Howard Ferris. And on the left is a little glob of carbon, probably from root and plant residues, above ground residues, and it shows the carbon going out to various levels of the soil food web and then back again. All this cycling going on by this, hopefully we think, very diverse set of organisms, at the lower level being bacteria and fungi, and then organisms that consume them. And then moving to the right to very high levels in the soil food web, where there's more predators. And so I'll be talking about this soil food web maybe from the point of view of microbes and nematodes today. So first of all, organic vegetable systems in California. This is rather old data. My understanding is that vegetable production in organic is continuing to increase. But you can see that California has a lot of vegetable production in the United States. What we've been working on over the years is a whole continuum of different kinds of farms with different market structures, from family farms to commodity agriculture. Remember, this is a summer dry Mediterranean climate, so these farms are operating usually with irrigation, and they are dry, no rainfall from about June to September. We are focusing on soil and plant biodiversity and ecosystem functions and trying to get that understanding of that basic ecology along with problem-solving, action-oriented outcomes. Our research has been on various different situations. I'm going to emphasize the on-farm aspect today, and we try to work with groups of people. It's not always easy to do that, but it's the best way, we think, to get the information exchange back and forth between ecological understanding and action. So my first study that I'm going to talk about is on transitioned organic production on two large conventional farms in the Salinas Valley. During the transition to organic from high-input conventional production, how does soil see microbial biomass see and crop yield change? So Salinas Valley, personally, I think it's one of the most intensive agricultural areas in the world. It's for crops that are lettuce, broccoli, celery. They rarely use the cover crop. These crops can be produced in the winter in California, though it's mainly during, it's usually not during the months from December and February. And so we worked with a company that had two large ranches that they took them suddenly from very intensive production to organic. It was a 3-year study. We had 81 sampling points on 27 transects. And we tried to use multivariate statistics to to capture what they were doing and how they use adaptive management to keep their organic systems productive. So they used many organic nutrient systems. They were under drip. They used organic pesticides and insect trees. Insect trees are shown like this flower strip here. Many commodities and diversity in plant populations. So just as something on the experimental design, here's the two ranches near the town of Salinas, and in every block we have three transects with three sampling points. And every time a harvest of a vegetable crop or cover crop occurred, we took the following samples shown here on the diagram. For soil, and the star indicates that that was taken at 15 to 30 as well. Above ground plants, roots for ant, fungi, weeds, diseases and insects, damage to the plants, and all the management inputs were provided by the grower. So it was a real partnership because you can imagine how much diversity was occurring. At the end of the study, I'm going to show data on total carbon and nitrogen. So first of all, about soil microbial biomass and related things. So from year 1 to 3, you can see the 3 years lined up with the seasons, summer, fall, winter, spring, and we looked at the data statistically season by season. So microbial biomass carbon increased in the most biologically active times of year, fall and spring. Remember, during the summer, if it doesn't rain, it's just a little bit of moisture right near the plant's drip tape. Fungal AM fungi increased in the summer crops and winter cover crops, and we saw the potentially minimalizable end doubled in the fall period. So what we saw was what I'd call a moderate change in soil microbiological activity, despite the fact that they were adding yearly additions of compost, cover crops, and chicken manure almost every year. And why was that? Why wasn't it more effective? Note that the levels of these things in summer of year one were quite low. So when we looked at total carbon, nitrogen, and management, we saw a little increase in carbon or nitrogen in any of the fields after 3 years. Those are the left-hand diagram shows each field one by one. And then we used multivariate analysis to look at what factors were most important for a percent increase in carbon or nitrogen from year one to year three. And you can see that a legume cover crop was the most important factor increasing those quantities. In other words, the biomass of the legume cover crop in any given plot increased the carbon and nitrogen percent increase. I'm going to switch a little and talk about the crop mix because that's an important part of the story. So once again, the years, 1, 2, 3, and where you can see on the top is the total area of plantings by crop. And you can see that in the winter and fall of last year, the number of cover crops really decreased. Cover crops, has been mentioned, are difficult to deal with when you've got vegetables you want to plant really early in the year. They also decreased the diversity of a lot of their crops. The number of tags have decreased, and the number of plantings per hectare decreased. So what was going on during this transition that caused the differences? What we did was we looked at the crop changes in relationship to relative yields. So relative yield was defined as this. At any given sampling date, take that yield and divide it by the taxon's maximum yield during any time of the 3 year period. And we found in this CART analysis, the single important thing deciding relative yield was crop choice, crop taxon. In other words, what we found was that some taxa, the ones on the right, had higher relative yields, and the ones on the left had lower relative yields. And so the reason for the decrease in crop diversity is they were going towards the varieties and crops that had higher relative yields. And they were also decreasing the cover crops. Well, just to summarize, the grower called this an uneventful transition. There was no period of crop yield loss, which often occurs on research station trials. Our crop tests were generally adequate for N, P, and K. Nitrogen carbon management improved somewhat. There was indicators of an increase in soil microbial functioning. Nitrate decreased markedly, which is important there because it's a very, very severe nitrate leaching problem in the county. So what we'd say is there was a learning curve. So we used trial and error to figure out the best suited crops and varieties. Trial and error with increased soil and fertilizer throughout the season. But really what they were doing was they were focusing on their yields and not on building soil carbon and microbial biomass. In their terms, it was successful, but it wasn't seeing as much as we could potentially have seen, I think. We feel like it was useful because we were sharing information back and forth in this participatory research. And although the multivariate statistics were able to show best management practices more than I've been able to talk about here, we couldn't really do that till the end of this study. But it was still useful for other new projects they put into place. My next part of the talk is on habitat comparison for an organic farmscape. This is in a little bit north of Salinas in the Sacramento Valley near University of California, Davis. So what we were interested in there is, and for a given farm, how do the different habitats differ in plant and soil biodiversity and ecosystem functions? Because that also might tell us something about microbial dynamics and functions. And so we had a two-year program on a whole variety of different things we measured. You can read them there. We looked at plant nematode and soil microbial diversity. So this farm had been in a farm for 15 years. It's along a creek. We had a riparian corridor, ditches, tailwater ponds, and hedgerows and fields as our habitat types. And there were also tailwater ponds for sediment capture. There was the same soil type in all the habitats, and crops were tomatoes and grains. So first of all, some benefits of farmscaping, which is a word to use for these various features that people do, like tailwater ponds or hedgerows, that kind of thing. One thing was sediment capture. The tailwater pond greatly increased sediment capture. So when the Northfield discharged, for example, the total suspended solids went down to almost nothing in the tailwater pond, and then that tailwater pond's water was recycled to the top of the field and used again. Carbon storage was especially high in the riparian corridor and the hedgerows. The riparian corridor stored about 18% of the farm's carbon on a 0 to 30 centimeter deep basis, less if you calculate it to 1 meter deep. We measured greenhouse gas emissions once a month for the 2 years, and of course this is just an estimate, but what it showed was that in all the habitats it was pretty similar carbon dioxide emissions, but they were really different from season to season between the forest and the irrigated crops. Nitrous oxide levels were very low, about an order of magnitude lower than the conventional fields we measured nearby. And they were higher in the tailwater pond and ditches, but even so, those were quite low levels. So the organic management was conducive to low nitrous oxide emissions and also to low nitrate leaching. But here's something that was a dilemma. When we looked at the difference between the wooded and cultivated habitats, we didn't see differences in fungal PLFA. They were essentially no-till. And we didn't see a difference in number of fungal feeding nematodes. And this was really strange because usually you would think if there was higher soil organic matter and there was no-till, we'd see more of these organisms. And so then you can just look at these different bars. They're all stacked in order to see that there weren't significant differences. And so we were curious about why is there this lack of increase in diversity of soil biota when we get more activity and more organic matter. So we said, well, does it do to past soil management? All these farms I'm talking about, including the ones I'll talk about next, were in conventional agriculture before. And or is it because there's few reservoirs of biodiversity in the landscape, or is it because it's a Mediterranean climate where any organism has to survive 6 months of drought in a natural ecosystem? So I'm going to jump away from this farm to a native riparian woodland reserve that is 3 kilometers away. And it's managed for biodiversity, mainly birds, but we decided to look at nematodes. And this is a picture of it. Very deep sides, it's quite pristine. And the topo map in the corner shows a particular predatory nematode, and the circles mean, a big circle means there's more of it, and then you have the orange being blue oak, the green madrone, and the blue toyon. And what was amazing is not only did we see a lot more nematode taxa, but we saw a lot of spatial heterogeneity. For example, this predator was higher abundance near the creek, that's the bottom x-axis, in under blue oak. Others showed preferences for other plant species. So what that's telling us is something before European settlement, we think, was conducive to high soil biodiversity in these riparian quarters, even though we're not seeing it today. Here's another quick look at a study that was done by Steve Coleman and Annie Young Matthews. I'm looking across that same landscape. The farm that I've been talking about up to now is the red dot at the very bottom of the map. And we used a GIS to get a representative sampling across what we're calling the simple landscape. It's simple in the sense it's grazed annual grassland and oak savanna on the west, irrigated row crops on the east. And we found minor differences in nematodes and PLFA along the creek versus the agricultural fields. So what's going on here? Why don't we see soil food webs with more diversity in the riparian corridors? Or why don't we see differences when there's more woody plants present? What I think is going on, and it's really hard to test this, is the fact that there's been a lot of erosion from these grasslands. There's been intensive high input, just as we've heard about from Kate and Lynn. All these effects on the biota may have built up over time so that we do occasionally find little hot spots in this landscape, but we don't have a lot of biodiversity as much as we would think to play around with, even in organic. So just to jump back to the organic farmscape, we found that soil biodiversity was quite similar across the habitats of the farmscape, possibly due to the past inputs and disturbances there. But ecological functions differed markedly. This farmer was doing a lot to increase the ecological function in his farm via farmscaping. And it did show up with higher microbial biomass and activity, but not in the soil biodiversity. So some of the outcomes that we found from the project is the farmer altered his cover crop management based on some of the work that we did on the fields, and he planted more woody plants because they seemed to be beneficial. And we've also used this data in statewide policy documents for climate change mitigation and adaptation, because right now as California builds its strategy for carbon, they need data, and it's helpful to have it on the soil type, the same soil type on these carbon pools and nitrous oxide emissions. The next study is a survey of organic fields in an intensive agricultural landscape. It's the same landscape that I talked about just now, except a bigger swath through the entire county. And so this study's objective is to work with growers to understand their different strategies for managing organically and how their landscape context and markets might affect their nutrient cycling, soil organic matter, and crop yields. And what we wanted to do, and this is still in progress, is identify the potential for a set of integrative indicators of plant soil nitrogen cycling for the future. So these were all organic tomato fields. What we're trying to do is look at how growers decide about agroecosystem management, how that affects plant soil microbial interactions across this inner landscape. You can see the little pins showing the farms in this valley part of that same area I showed before, and then how that in turn might affect the grower decisions. So you can see here from this diagram that there were several farms, 13 fields, a variety of certified organic crops from either on the farm being a mixture of conventional or organic, or all organic, processing versus fresh tomatoes, all the same roma type, and differences in the primary organic inputs, differences in the soluble or guano inputs, and irrigation being either furrow or drip irrigation. And we picked these farms using a GIS-based approach to get a representative set of farms across the entire landscape. So I'm just going to condense this down due to lack of time. And this is a PCA of soil and crop, just sort of state variables of mid-season summer sampling, with the x-axis representing going from left to right, higher crop yield and nitrogen availability, and the y-axis going from lower soil carbon and at the bottom to higher inorganic N at the top. And what we're seeing here is a situation where we see basically three clusters of fields. We see low yield fields that just had big problems. And then we saw a range of fields. I'll show later that they had fairly consistent yields, many above the county average, where one set of fields had high inorganic N, soil ammonium, nitrate, petiol nitrate, a little higher shoot N, and the other set of fields had soils with more carbon, more total N, available carbon as well. And so the blue arrow sort of shows one trajectory of farms, and the yellow arrow shows another that was really based more on high soil carbon availability. And what we wanted to dissect a little bit more is what caused the tightly coupled carbon and nitrogen cycling in the bottom set of farms, so that, you know, we had decent yields, but we didn't have the potential for nitrate leaching. So this is a paper that Tim had out last year in Soil Biology and Biochemistry, and it's comparing potential enzyme activity with FAMES with potential enzyme activity and FAME profiles, and this was very kindly done by Veronica Costa Martinez, and so we were grateful to for this collaboration. What was interesting is across the set of fields, soil potential enzyme activity differed more than soil microbial communities. On your left, you'll see that the arrangement of fields is pretty similar to the one I just showed in the last diagram, with fields with higher potential nitrogen cycling enzyme activity in the lower right, where soil carbon was higher. In the upper part of the diagram, enzymes related to carbon release were higher, so that microbial communities seem to be triggering some sort of enzymatic N release when N might be more limited to them, and nitrogen release when carbon is more limited. And possibly this makes it under the higher carbon situation, a situation where plants can acquire N even when ammonium and nitrate pools are small. When you look at the FAMES in the other diagram, its axes explain a lot less of the variation, and they're more on top of each other, less variation. Once again, supporting the idea that we don't have a lot of variation in community in this landscape. This is what we call plants' eye view of soil nitrogen cycling, and something we've worked on a lot is looking at root gene expression, quantitative PCR and microarray on organic farms. So the idea is this, is if we see high rates of nitrogen metabolism genes in roots, and there's low inorganic N pools, what does that mean? It could mean that the plants are actively taking up N, metabolizing N, but the pool size is low. And isn't that what we're looking for? Because then we don't have the leaching potential, the nitrous oxide potential. And so that's what we show here across the different farms. Is this is the GTS1 enzyme. It's one of the number we looked at, but it's the one that shows the most effect. And it's an enzyme that controls the ammonium assimilation into the root. And its expression is better associated with microbial activity, potentially mineralized land or microbial biomass, than it is with ammonium or nitrate in the soil. So what we think this is showing is that when we manage for high soil microbial activity, and we have this ability of microbes to increase their potential enzyme activity for nitrogen release, they just showed the plant available N is still there, even though the pool size is low. And this is just an agronomic slide showing on your right that at harvest, 9 of the 13 fields were above the Yolo County average. A couple were quite a bit below it, as I already mentioned. And when we looked at total above ground nitrogen concentration against total above ground biomass, kind of a typical agronomic measure is in the dotted line is a critical shoot nitrogen concentration for tomatoes at the mid-season. But most of the fields were pretty close to the critical end concentration at the beginning, at mid-season. So in other words, sort of regardless of which strategy we saw in the soil, the plants were doing pretty well in terms of nitrogen acquisition. And this is really to the credit of these growers who fine-tuned their own system in different ways. I should have mentioned back here, if I can get back here, well, I should have mentioned something in that enzyme graph that where we did see the highest end release potential activity of enzymes were situations where people had been using composted green waste manure. And we think that there may be something about using that material that's somewhat resistant to degradation that improved the soil carbon availability in the soils. So just moving on to this last section, just one last slide of my talk, is what can we learn from these on-farm studies? First of all, organic vegetable production in California uses lots of diverse sets of soil management practices that support reliable yield. And they're often related to the type of market system that people have. But regardless of that, we could show that tiglet-coupled nitrogen cycling in which we had available N and low nitrate pools was possible. And it seems largely due to soil activity, to the release of enzymes that increase nitrogen availability to the plant, and in turn the plant roots in the right place at the right time to take up that N that's released. And we think that including resistant high C-N inputs may contribute to a more effective N cycling in this way. For sure, it's not the only input. These people were using many other things, but there's something about that that seems to be important in these tomato systems. We think that there's legacy effects that may result from the past history of high input intensive agricultural production here, that there are weak soil biodiversity function relationships, that farm management seems to affect soil activity more than biodiversity. And that may be because we don't have a reservoir anymore in the landscape. We have a very, very simple landscape without vegetation remnants hanging around anymore. Our riparian corridors are really vulnerable to erosion, and they get big inputs and scouring during rainfall events in the winter. So what we're doing now is we're really focusing on farm innovations that increase ecological functions. And we keep looking for the changes in biodiversity, and we have some hints for like where we might find this. It's almost like a treasure hunt. Where are we going to find this? And we'd like to do this more and more with groups of farmers, because we found, even though it was complicated to get information back to farmers, I can talk more about that, they weren't super keen on having big group meetings, but we did have a way that we conveyed all the information to all the farmers, and we think that's a really effective learning mechanism. And finally, I want to give acknowledgments to the funders and symposium organizers. Thank you.
Louise, if you could stay here, and Lynn and Kate, if you could come back up, we can bombard them with questions. For those of you that have recently come in, Matt Wallenstein became ill and was not able to make it to the meeting. So we have some extra time. So I think rather than just taking a super long break, might be better to take advantage of the time and ask some questions of our prior speakers and get some discussion going. Question down here in front.
Yeah, for the last speaker, it appears that that the vegetable farmers are importing a lot of carbon and nitrogen into their system, so they're organic. Mm-hmm. Do you think that is having a big impact on their biodiversity?
Okay. I say that all of them do import compost or manure. Either one. A couple of our growers actually don't. There's one fellow who uses an alfalfa rotation and cover crops, and he has excellent yields. He has many of the criteria of soil quality we'd look for, so he's not importing things in. His biodiversity is also quite low. So, good question. Thank you.
Question over here.
Yeah, it's really lovely. All three of you come from xeric moisture regimes, these Mediterranean type climates, but also regions that are historically fire ecologies. Am I right? Have you had a look to see what the role of residual charcoal might be in your soil, and have you given some consideration to maybe bolstering that in one way or another? I don't want to say biochar winfinity solves all problems, but I'm curious whether or not you already have got charcoal taking an active role in the soil, and then whether or not you could improve conditions if, in fact, you were to attempt that somewhat.
Yes, well, in Western Australia, there are traces of charcoal, very small. There are also experiments where biochar has been added with very little effect.
Okay.
And that's pretty characteristic of our environment.
We haven't looked for, like, the presence of charcoal in the soils per se, but we do have long-term biochar plots going now at Russell Ranch, using a locally made biochar from walnuts and looking at impacts on crop yields. And these are really great soils, Yolo Solo. These are not your really damaged soils that you would expect advantages. But there's been both yield increases and declines depending on the crop in the presence of biochar. And the other thing that the biochar seems to do is play a big role in aggregation. In these really high clay soils, it seems to maybe nucleate aggregates. So, but a lot still to learn. And impacts on communities, but what does it mean? Don't know. Yeah.
Question over here.
Are we getting anywhere close to being able to make recommendations and limits in reference to the wonderful slide about the adaptation of tillage by soil type? In regards to soil microbial population dynamics, growth, what I call establishment, reestablishment, and their fluctuations before, like, say, long periods of no-till, going into that beneficial tillage period. So that cycling in regards to, of course, it's going to be site-specific, but do we have any idea about time frames or intervals in relation to that within the body of knowledge of graph?
I probably can't answer your question, but in Western Australia, no-till uptake was really sudden. It was just overnight. I mean, it takes some years, but farmers just got onto it really quickly, and so there wasn't a lot of transition. And you don't see people going out of no-till. It's not going back the other way either, occasionally, but I can't really tell you the answer that you'd probably like. Sorry.
This question here.
Another aspect for a mountain of organic matter or active carbon or
It seems like that's still the variable. Yes, I think that you can't just say carbon, you can't just say clay. They're all the dimensions of it as well. And not even just the type of carbon, it's not the amount, it's the type. So how do you put all these complexities together? And my view is that the farmers are the people who know their land and are managing their land. And given them a little bit more information and support, that they're the ones that are going to make the difference. The scientists are not going to. They're way ahead because they're implementing. And they really want to know. But we can't give them an answer, but we can stimulate them enough to make good decisions. I think that's the way we look at it.
A question in the back here. Go ahead.
The live speaker, what on the farms you were surveying in your data set, what were the sources of the higher carbon nitrogen compost materials that resulted in higher nitrogen carbon?
We, almost all of those farms, I can go back to that slide. I think I skipped. So when we had composted green waste in those fields 11, 12, and 13, we had composted green waste was present in those fields. And that's where we saw the higher potential activity of nitrogen-releasing enzymes. That was in those fields if they also were supplying other forms of nitrogen like soluble N. But that seemed to be one of the key factors for getting to the tighter nitrogen cycling.
Was the green waste right off of the barn itself?
Oh, no, sorry. These were probably municipal green waste operations in California where they collect the green waste from yards in the neighborhoods and then they compost it. Sorry about not that lack of clarity on that. So it was probably more woody material than would be normally found in green waste on farms.
What's the whether it's green waste or livestock waste, the compost versus putting fresh on it? What's from the microbial standpoint? Is there a change there, or what's the significance of compost?
I'm not really sure. I was surprised that the source of material made that that we could even detect the input of those green waste, because in other studies we've done with municipal green waste, we haven't seen much changes in microbial biomass with just that as the one variable. So I'm a little confused on what's going on here. Like, why would I'm putting on these yearly inputs make a difference on the enzyme activity? Yeah. I found that in an earlier study in the Salinas Valley, and this is just a wild guess, is that when you incorporate the cover crop and you put a high C2N municipal green waste compost on right afterwards, I'm wondering if you stimulate microbial activity by the input of this very labile material. But then you give them a little, not to keep them going for a while, too. So I think there's something going on about having them together in time, even not just spatial or temporally separated, but we can't test that with these data sets here.
And I think there's something about location of where the material is, like with the below ground roots of the cover crops, and how much that contributes, just where it is and whether it's set up ready to integrate in with the mineral fraction or not. And the other thing that's interesting is bringing in drip now, and now you don't have necessarily the water where that material is, and that those discontinuities in locations of the resources that microbes need that I think are going to open up a bunch of new questions.
Yeah, I think these are all good points. What I tried to bring up, earlier, or did bring up earlier, was that, you know, these are significant challenges. What do you measure and when do you measure it? So until we can get a little better handle on that, that we're going to continue to have all this, you know, different types of conclusions from different systems, and so we have to look at them collectively and start to maybe standardizing some measurement practices, and then we can start in these different systems and then start taking that data apart and seeing, okay, what caused these differences and why are they how they are. Any other questions? We still have plenty of time. Go ahead.
Just one comment for Lynn. In Western Canada, we have very heavy plate soils that are very productive under no till, and we have a free spa cycle of freezing. So be careful equaling disturbance with a heavy plate soil. I'm not sure how heavy the clays are in South America, but they have a lot of no till there too, so that might be a good place to look for how much disturbance we need in a non-heavy.
I'm appreciative. I think I like to try and understand things, and I think by putting a hypothesis out, then we can start to unpick it. And I think that there might be layers and layers here, and it might. I'm really of the view that understanding local is really important, and trying to put all the dimensions into one little hypothesis that cover all realities is dangerous. But I think we've got to move beyond just no-till fantastic in every situation, because clearly there are situations where, and even in Western Australia, when no-till was introduced, it was like a religion. And the idea of disturbing soil was just, don't go there, don't mention that you should disturb the soil. And it was really quite outrageous, really. But now these same people are saying there's a problem in some situations and we do need to disturb it. So I was just taking it from a microbiological point of view, and what's the ecology going? How is that working? What do we need to get that right in this situation? So that's the way I've looked at disturbance. And Michael Houston's model is that disturbance can be all sorts of things. I mean, the freezing and thawing is disturbance too, so that there's layers within this. But I will keep playing around with the concept. So thanks for your comment.
Yeah, Lynn, and I would like to thank you. It's just one of the nicest compilations of practical information as well as presenting challenges I've ever seen. I think if farmers were actually able, even though in some cases we'd say it's a little bit above their level, I disagree. I think if they saw some of these things, it would get them some reason to do some of the things that they would like to do. I think they look at us sometimes as we're so far above them that we don't communicate. I think this is very well communicated. The question I have is, especially in your disturbance, in Western Ohio, Eastern Indiana, we had a group of folks that practiced the religion and found out that their clays were not necessarily, after a certain time, being productive. The level of disturbance seems to me to be practical based on that soil texture. Because I noticed in the picture you showed with the sandy texture and just the grazing, isn't it maybe something that just enough crust removal based on the soil texture is enough? Because I think some of our folks are finding that an inch or two of surface tillage in the clay is enough to allow the air to work with the microbial diversity and the quality of it. Is that a part of it?
Yes, I think I tried to mention at the beginning that no-till was a very different thing depending, and it's the equipment that people are using is also very different. And my first experience of the no-till trials in Western Australia was a big experiment. The one for people, they set up this big display, and I went there and I just couldn't believe it because it was very disturbed to me. And partly that is that there was no organic matter maintained, the cover was poor. So I always have that in my mind, that this sandy no-till was really quite disturbed. And then at the other extreme, the heavier soils were probably not very disturbed. So it's site-specific, and understanding your own system is really what it's about. So.
Thank you.